Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 211 of the podcast, and I'm joined in conversation by Lauren Johnson. Lauren is a mental performance coach for professional athletes and entrepreneurs. Before starting her consultancy practice that she runs now, Lauren served as the mental conditioning coordinator for the New York Yankees and has so much to tell from that time and in recent years. Lauren's mission is to help people improve their lives through the choices they make. And this episode is going to empower you to do exactly that and be elite by choice and work your way to mindset mastery. You can expect to learn about the resilience and alignment it required for Lauren to work in her dream career, the formula you can employ to build the identity and the life that you want, the biggest differences between good performers and the very elite ones, how to manage your self-talk, and even how to manage a high-performance life as your business and family commitments evolve over time. This episode is jam-packed and one of my favorite conversations that I've had so far this year. If you enjoy this and you know someone else that would benefit from these lessons and insights that improve your mindset, then please do take the time to share it with them, as the show really does grow to the stage it's got to with one recommendation at a time from you guys. Today's podcast is not brought to you by one of my usual sponsors. In fact, it is brought to you by my upcoming podcast masterclass. Most podcasts fail. The vast majority do not make it past episode 8, and in another several hundred thousand podcasts fail before episode 24. The odds on a podcast being successful are very, very remote, but that does not need to be you. The benefits and opportunities that I've unlocked and created over the last 3 years through podcasting have been incredible from a business perspective, a personal brand perspective, a networking perspective, and it also allows you to be authority in the space that you're interested in. I've learned so much myself from building a podcast to the top 1% globally, and I know that I can share that with you. I've distilled those lessons and experiences down into a 9-module video course, which will be delivered over on my website, and it includes video guides, templates, frameworks, copy and paste, things that you can send out to secure the best possible guests, and even my secrets to researching and preparing for interviews. It's due to release in the next 7 days if you're listening to this in early October, and all you need to do to register your interest in advance is DM me on Instagram or on LinkedIn the word masterclass, and I will add you to the early bird offering before I release it. Now, that's quite enough from myself. This podcast starts at a really quick pace with Lauren and I. We really get started, but you've got almost 60 minutes with the two of us in full flow, and I learned so much from Lauren, and I know you will too. The music's about to play, and I hope you enjoy this one.
Mindset is not everything, but it impacts everything. Because I had a moment where I walked into a Yankees locker room with a bunch of staff members I was working with, and I was chatting it up with one of these members, our staff members, and he looked at me and he goes, "Yeah, Lauren, mindset is everything." And I had one of those moments where, like, I knew what he meant, but I recognized that it wasn't entirely true. Because if that was the case, then none of these coaches mattered. And then I thought to myself, like, why am I not a major league, you know, in the major leagues if mindset is everything? And that's what I teach. And that's when I kind of realized that, oh, it's not, mindset is not everything, but it does impact everything. And so you can't just have a good mindset and think everything else is solved. You know, not many people can stand, in the box as a hitter and do what a lot of these guys do. Not a lot of people could stand on the mound and accurately throw a 90-mile-an-hour fastball down the middle. And so it was when I realized that it really is this idea of you, all the things that you bring, all the skills that you have. And when you pair that with some of these mental tools, that's when the level of what you do can rise.
Absolutely. I completely agree. Otherwise, as you say, anyone that maybe just worked particularly hard on their mental game, they would, of course, be competing at the top level in whatever they turned their hands to. But there needs to be an element of talent, technique, and all these other things that combine. And then, of course, the mindset is what's unlocking that higher level of performance or that consistent level of performance, which those elite guys have.
Exactly. Exactly. And it really comes down to each individual person because it's different, right? It's kind of like, I like to describe it as a formula. Is that your skill levels, your circumstances, your personality, all these things go into what kind of makes the perfect formula for you. All those things go into what kind of makes the perfect recipe for you. So that's why I kind of look at it as like almost like a pairing, you know, like good wine and cheese. It's like it's a pairing of like a mental skill based on you, your circumstances, and really the goals you're looking to achieve.
Absolutely. When did you first start to show an interest in this space of mental performance and sports psychology?
Honestly, I didn't even know it was a thing for a long time. I really started showing interest because I was the athlete that needed it. And ironically, it was after my career. I played soccer at the collegiate level, and it was third game into my senior year when I received my fifth concussion, and I was told it wasn't safe to play. And so even though I was still part of the team, I went to practice, you know, I traveled with the team and all that, you know, my role was not on the field anymore. It was on the bench. And so it playing a very supportive role. And so I decided, you know, I wanted to take an elective course, you know, to keep myself busy, have another thing to work on. And I found a course in sports psychology. And I realized that as I was going through it, I realized all these things, like looking back, right? Hindsight is always 20/20, but looking back, I was like, who would I have been if I would have known these things? And then I thought, how many people can I help now that I do? And that became kind of, you know, my guiding light as I left college and went on to pursue a master's degree.
That's fantastic, because sometimes setbacks like that can lead people off track, but often they actually align you to where you are meant to be going. And that, as your career's transpired, is clearly in helping others to unlock that element of their mental performance. But it's great that in those initial stages, you were like, oh, this would have been great for Lauren the athlete, and I could have done with this earlier.
Yeah, it's so true. And I heard somebody say this, and I think it's so true. The things that break us bond us. And it's, you know, there's many aspects, right, of each of our lives where we can pull on certain things that kind of broke us and to some degree. And I think that was one of them for me, where I went, oh my gosh, I can feel what that athlete is feeling. I can feel what that, even though maybe I wasn't in business at the time, I could relate it to something I felt on the soccer field, and or things that I saw in conversations or things that I heard talking to other athletes or other business professionals. And I just saw that there was this common thread between the two. And that's kind of how not only I got the chance to work in not only sports, but now I work a lot in business as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because when you maybe lose an element of your identity growing up, because I imagine to get to the collegiate level in soccer, you must have been one of the better players in high school, one of the better performers, and there would always be, maybe at family gatherings, it would be like, oh, how's Lauren's soccer going? And those questions are always around that. So when the identity is taken away from you through injury, and then for many other people, maybe they don't quite make it to the very, very top level because of they don't get picked, or they haven't quite made it through maybe their mindset, who knows? It can be really difficult to have like a rebirth and move into this next level of identity. So it's interesting that you chose a field that was still related to sport, but was obviously in a slightly different domain in terms of you weren't the actual performer yourself.
Yeah, you know, I think I'll never forget this. It was my senior year banquet. So I had hurt myself, went through a whole season of not playing, but really playing a supportive role. And at your senior banquet, especially particularly ours, all the seniors stood up and said a little something. And it's not like you prepared, you just, you know, you went up, you said your thanks, you know, your kind of final goodbyes, and that was it. Well, it was weird. Like I walk up just thinking I'm going to keep it really simple, you know, and I just had this like thought come over me, and without rehearsing it, I just said, this year was the most fulfilling year of soccer. And I didn't step on the field. I didn't score one goal. I didn't have any stats. I realize that when I had the opportunity, whether I chose it or it was forced, to look outside of myself and extend any bit of experience that I had or any thought that I had that could potentially help somebody, when I was able to do that, I realized that I was so much more fulfilled. And it was like a full circle moment where I went, I knew there was a purpose to it. I always believe things happen for a reason, but I just didn't quite know it when I was in it. And it was like, I had a moment to reflect back and go, I'm so thankful I had the opportunity to serve others and to see sport and athletics from the different lens. And it made it very clear to me, like what I wanted to do in this life was to be able to serve others in a way that helped them unlock their potential in ways that I don't think I was able to, at least from a sporting perspective.
Of course, you've had a way with words even from back then, Lauren. That's great to be able to, to stand up and present in that atmosphere with something that sounded quite profound. That's amazing. But I know that it wasn't a straight path from turning your qualifications towards sports psychology and then ending up with the Yankees and then in the role that you do now. I want to go to a time when you had perhaps a difficult conversation in Starbucks and understand what was happening at that point in your life.
Oh man, I have to say that was one of my, to this day, it's one of my favorite days I had. At the time it was not, but as you said, after I graduated with my master's program, from my master's program, I had 2 job offers on the line. And I was so excited. Like, I was on cloud 9. Like, I didn't only have 1 offer, I had 2, and I got to choose. So after really thinking through it, I chose one, turned down the other. But the only catch was the one that I chose, it was going to take about 6 months to be placed in that role, which was very common for that role. 6 months goes by and I don't hear anything. So I finally reach out and they respond to me and say, "We're sorry, the job is no longer available." So I was heartbroken. I couldn't go back. They already filled the other role that I said no to. It's been 6 months, like, they've moved on. I called everybody I knew and I kept hearing the same thing. "Lauren, you just need experience," which is like the most frustrating thing to hear right out of grad school. 'Cause you're like, "What do you think I'm trying to do?" Like, that's exactly what I'm trying to do. And so I realized, I'm like, well, I got to make money because my student loans are coming up. I've got to make money somehow, so I can't be sitting and waiting for another job. I've got to go find one. So I decided to get a job at Starbucks, and I was working the drive-thru. And as you're working the drive-thru, it's your job to keep the customer entertained while their drink's being made. So I'm sitting and chatting up with this guy, and he goes, "So are you in school?" Which was a very fair question, because most were. And I proudly told him, like, "No, I actually just graduated. I actually just graduated from my graduate program." He's like, "That's great. What'd you get your degree in?" And I proudly told him, "Performance psychology." And he just starts laughing. Like, the kind of laughing that's like not with you, it's at you. And I waited till he was done laughing. And I finally asked him, I said, "What's so funny?" And he said, "Oh, you got one of those degrees you'll never use." And I was like, I mean, my mouth dropped wide open. I couldn't believe he just said that to me. I was kind of like stunned. Have you ever had that feeling where somebody says something and you're not ready for it? And you're just like stunned and you don't know how to respond. So I just got up and I walked out. I couldn't even hand him his drink. I asked somebody else to, and I was so upset. And I kept ruminating on what he said throughout the rest of my shift. And every time I would re-listen in my mind to him saying that to me, I would experience all the same frustrations over again. And I would just get really frustrated. And then at this moment, when I got home, I was like mad because I was mad. I'm like, this guy doesn't matter. Why does he have so much power over you? And that's when I had this like light bulb moment. And I realized I wasn't mad because he was rude. I was mad because he was right. Like, here I am after hitting an obstacle, and I'm now just waiting for something to fall in my lap. I'm waiting for another job to come to me because you won't get very far if you turn around at your first sign of adversity. And he shined a light on it. And that's why I was so upset. And so I think I can look back and thank him, because he really sparked me to explore a different path, which kind of led me, you know, to where I am today.
The harshest criticisms are often the ones that ring true, but they also sting the most because of the nature of the true element. Like you say, I wonder if somebody that you were maybe closer to had maybe been like, "Oh, Lauren, why are you still working in Starbucks? What are you going to do to find a vacancy that you're really passionate about? What are you going to do to use your degree in an area that you clearly care about and you've got a contribution to make?" You might have not taken it as harshly as the stranger at the drive-thru who just said it verbatim, like no holds bars, and just went for you.
Couldn't agree more. People are like, "Oh, wouldn't you want to find him today?" I said, I would hug him. I would say thank you because I needed it. I needed that. And exactly to your point, I needed it from somebody that I didn't already have a relationship with, because I could explain away why I was working at Starbucks, just like I was every single day when I woke up. I gave my own reasons for why sitting in the comfort and waiting for another job to come along was the right choice. But by him doing that, it sparked me to do something about it. It created a sense of urgency in me that nothing else prior to that had. And so that night I Googled how to start your own consulting company, started my own consulting company, didn't know what the heck I was doing. I had no clue, probably did a lot wrong. And after a year's time of building up a clientele with like sending out 10 emails a day, getting so many no's, lots of ignores, and every once in a while a yes, I built up a decent resume of people I was working with, and I had the opportunity to interview at the Yankees, and I got the job.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Drive-Thru Man.
Right?
It's like a blessing in disguise, isn't it, sometimes when somebody rocks the boat like that? But like anything, if that's the stimulus, there's a gap that allows you to choose how you're going to respond. And that's something that I've learned from a lot of the different psychologists and wise people that I've had to interview over the last 3 years. Because using that time to respond, because obviously your immediate response was a visceral reaction of upset, anger, frustration. But the correct thing to do, as shown, was to go and take action to move you towards what you really were meant to be doing, which was building the experience to make you undeniable when it came to the interview for the job that you really wanted. And of course, that wasn't immediately obvious when your job fell through. It wasn't immediately obvious to go and get the consultancy gig, to email out, to call out, to do potentially free work, I'm sure I've heard you say before, during that period to build up your resume. That isn't immediately obvious until you maybe have a motivator or a driver that pushes you towards that.
Oh, isn't that the truth? And I've heard you say this on previous episodes that you've done, but it's that idea of like, good is the enemy of great. You know, it's that region beta paradox where it's sometimes the more distressing events are the things that can actually get the needle moving, while less distressing ones actually don't create as much of a sense of urgency. So we get reasonably comfortable and complacency follows. And that's what was happening to me. I was not in a good place, but I wasn't in a horrendous place. I wasn't happy, but I wasn't miserable. And so I think that when it got called out to me and shined the light on the excuses I was making to stay comfortable and to not go after the thing that I wanted and to allow adversity to keep me exactly where I was, that's the thing that helped me move the needle. And I think that we can all relate to that, whether you're an athlete, a business professional, or just an individual wanting to improve. I think we've all had those moments where we could go, ah, I'm comfortable. That's why the needle's not moving. And sometimes we wait till we're in extreme discomfort to make those changes when we really don't have to.
Completely agree. And that was a quote that I enjoyed sharing with Dr. Julie Gerner, who works in a very similar space to yourself. And she was a fantastic guest and we had a great conversation. And the C word that you used there, comfort, it's something that we're all striving for in terms of there's certain areas where we should be comfortable, like covering our base needs, our food at the table, our roof over our heads, our warmth in our shelter, whatever else you want to add into that kind of the bottom strand on Maslow's hierarchy of needs. But when we become too comfortable, and you were comfortable in your story of the unfortunate situation with the job falling through and the working in Starbucks until something comes along, it took something to shake you away from that comfort. And then you took massive action. And I can only imagine the level of satisfaction in the work and the hard graft you did that opened the doors to being getting the opportunity to work with the Yankees. Because if you picture that when you left college, that would be like potentially one of the dream jobs, wouldn't it? But the path to it is never going to be particularly simple unless you, I don't want to say lucky, but you are a product of particular circumstances which enables that. You had to create those circumstances yourself, and that feels probably even better than if it were handed to you.
Absolutely. I think that there's a direct correlation to satisfaction and the effort that you put in to get something. The harder you work, the more satisfying it is when you achieve it. And equally, the harder you work, the more devastating it is when you don't. But to me, it's kind of like that, I'm going to forget his name right now, but remind me, it's the quote about, you know, being the man in the arena, about like, I would rather know what it's like to experience extreme defeat, because what that says is that I tried and I put everything that I could into it, regardless of what the outcome was, because I really truly define, I define success not as an outcome. I also don't define failure as an outcome. I define it as the things within my control. Was I able to do those things? And did I do them at a high level? If that's the case, I can be okay with what the outcome is. It doesn't mean I'll settle with it. It doesn't mean I stay with it. I might keep trying, but I'm okay with it.
Yeah, it's that agreement within yourself that the efforts that I'm putting in are worthwhile. The juice is worth the squeeze is something that I continually say on the podcast, and people will be laughing into their AirPods because they'll hear me say it so often. But if you're on a path that it feels worthwhile and the feedback that you're getting is relatively reinforcing, it doesn't have to be immediately gratifying, because that's one of the big challenges we face. We've got so much immediate gratification and so much immediate escapism from the day-to-day is so important. But by the time you got to the Yankees, one of the things I really want to understand is, what were some of the key differences you noticed in terms of the guys that were there that were performing at a good level, and then the elite people, the guys that were like at the top?
What I found to be really fascinating was the degree of consistency. And it wasn't consistency necessarily in results themselves. It was consistency in the things within their control. So how they managed their emotions, you're pretty consistent. You would know if they struck out, you would know how they would react and respond. You would know how they would work to get themselves back on track. If somebody had an excellent game, you saw what they did to evaluate their performance. You saw what they pulled from it so that they can repeat it. And they took note of what those things were. Because I think when you see anyone that has good results over a decent amount of time, they have a system. And so I think for the people that did really well, you noticed that they had very clear systems and they were always evolving them. So, and it wasn't necessarily big changes. Sometimes they actually did a little addition through subtraction in their own process. But I like to pull a term from actually computer science with coding, and it's called refactoring. So if you write a code and this is the outcome that you achieve, refactoring is getting the same outcome, but simplifying the code, so making it shorter. And so that's, I think, what the high performers do really well, is not only do they have a system that they can rely upon and they're willing to stick with it through the ups and downs, but they're not also immune to refactoring. They also understand that it's a consistent evolution of themselves that makes them so great.
That's an incredibly good insight. And something that I've tried to rally against with the podcast is, sometimes when we're looking at pursuing the best version of ourselves, we're always adding in and adding in and adding in. So I'm going to add grounding to my morning routine. I'm going to add breath work. I'm going to add journaling. I'm going to add guided meditation. I'm going to add cold water. Okay, fantastic. But there are a finite number of hours in the day, and we're not all able to have an 8-hour morning routine. Otherwise, what else gets done? And one of the things that speaks to me from what you said there is that some of the top performers are looking to reduce down and make things simpler. So maybe finding the things that really do work, and of course you use the C word again, consistency, they're relentlessly consistent with the things that do work for them. So it might be the pre-game routine that one of the top batsmen has. He just does it over and over and over again. But there might be a younger guy who's on his way up who's maybe including some other things that he thinks might work. And of course, he should be experimental. But once he finds what works, he should copy or emulate the more successful batsmen, the more long-term but successful batsmen, because he's found what's worked and just carried on with it for him.
Yeah, and I think it's really important. I think it's like what you said, like what works for him. I think it's really important is it's fine to you know, borrow somebody's process or start with something that you can see works for somebody else. But understanding that works for that, what works for them may not work for you. And so, but how do you know if you don't try it? So sometimes it's a process of trying, eliminating, evolving, and giving feedback to yourself that ultimately helps you find what works best for you. It's kind of like at the very beginning when we were talking about kind of this idea of mindset is not everything, but it impacts everything. you're right, it does impact everything. And so what is your formula that impacts you in the best way? And it's also equally important to know what things impact you the most in a negative way, or maybe a more net neutral way. I think those are all really important things to know about yourself, because the more aware you are, the more mentally flexible you can be.
That's a great point, Warren. One of the things that immediately springs to mind when you use that particular phrase is, I know that if I'm on my phone later at night before I go to bed, I have a lesser quality night's sleep, and my ability to perform the next day is inhibited. My ability to adhere to my nutrition structure, to my morning routine, to my workflow is lower. So if I was looking at things to remove, or things that I know downregulate me to a lower frequency and a lower quality, it's maybe things like that. So I love the fact that it's not just thinking about what are the things that I do well within my routine or within my life that fuel me and push me in the right direction, but what else can I try and remove, or what do I know is a trigger for potential negatives?
Exactly. Because I always look at these words like mindset, impact, consistency. They have a bright side and a shadow side. You can have a good mindset. You can have an incredibly terrible mindset. You can have a good impact. You can have a negative impact. You can have, like, so everything has its own shadow, right? So if you're going to ask yourself, what do you want? Make sure you're also asking, what don't you want? If you're going to say, hey, what should I focus on? Also be sure to ask yourself, what should I ignore? If you're going to ask yourself, like, what's the cost of doing this? Also ask yourself, what's the cost of if I don't? And so I think what that allows is it allows these two, like the thought itself, you can be consistently bad at something just as well as you can be consistently good at something. So I just think when we look at these words, I like to look at them from those two lenses so that we can really see a little bit better of a bigger picture. And while we all have blind spots, we're humans and those will happen. Some of these, asking these questions help lead us to clearer answers.
When you ask yourself those questions, Lauren, what sits on that shadow side for you?
Let's see. The shadow side of consistency for me is I can tend to lean towards the pattern of being a workaholic. I can get so tied up in what I'm doing and like the pursuit that I can have blinders on and I ignore things that are really important in my life. And that to me has been something I've known for a long time and something I still struggle to master from time to time. And I recognize if I'm in a difficult area of my life or I'm carrying some sort of feeling of like, I have to take this on and it becomes a have to versus a get to, that's when I fall into that trap.
When the language changes.
Yes. And so I recognize that pattern for myself. So when those words start to come into play for me or that feeling, because I get a very visceral feeling, I try to like flag it so that I can sit down and like discover it and learn. Like I write it, I have to write things down because when I internalize it, I can ignore it. When I put it externally, now I have to face it. And so that to me is a really good, helpful tool for myself.
I was about to say that's another really common habit and trait that I've seen among my successful guests where they get things out of the top few inches of their head and onto paper and externalize it. And typically paper as well, actually not even digital phones, because we're so normalized to that one screen and that one dimension. Our brains aren't evolutionarily evolved to realize. So sometimes using different senses with the touch of the paper and the kind of pen and the kind of kinetic fibers that's connecting, it can enable you to really get your thoughts a lot clearer. So I love that you have that as a habit where some of the, I don't want to say negative self-talk, but some of that shadow self-talk pops up about the activities that you're doing or the tasks that are ahead. And then by writing it out, you can identify, okay, that's true. That is the case. It's not just a bad day at the office.
Right. And then the question becomes, what is most helpful in times like these? And I can look at it and go, okay, what are my choices? Because I think sometimes when we're in those moments, we feel like we don't have choices, but you always have a choice, but sometimes it can be forgotten. And so for me, sometimes I forget that I have choices within it. Even if I can't in my mind, like drop a project, I can change the way I look at it. And so I like to say, make it meaningful. And so, like, for instance, if I'm working on a project that I'm just like, oh my gosh, I just feel so overwhelmed. I have so many projects. This is like on the lower end. I try to make it mean something to me. And I go, let's think about the people on the other side. When I don't look at it as like an assignment and I look at it through the lens of I'm helping someone and there's people that are going to be receiving this on the other end, that's when I can connect meaning. And so for me, in some of those times, like maybe I can't change the fact that I'm in this. Maybe I signed a contract and I can't get out of it. Then I have to go, I still have a choice in it. And that is how I show up. That is who, what I choose to focus on and the meaning I assign to it. And so when I write those things out, I can make those distinctions. Sometimes in my head, I can get a little lost.
As a little bit of a self-confessed workaholic, how's life changed with the birth of your son, Grayson?
Oh my gosh. I love that little guy. I'm going to get all emotional. Oh, he is my world. He has changed everything for me. In like the best way. I think I'm emotional because his birthday just happened.
Yeah,
and I'm
so
like, how do I have a 1-year-old?
Birthday, yeah.
I'm like, how do I have a 1-year-old? But it's changed my priorities in the best of ways. It's highlighted things that are so vastly important to me, in a way that nothing else has. And it's funny, I heard somebody, I'm going to forget who said this, but I was listening to a little clip online and it talked about, I think it was on the Lewis House podcast, and I talked about, one of the guests said, you know what I wish for my enemies? I wish them all the success in the world. And she said, because when you achieve that success, when you get that trophy, I think you finally realize that all of the efforts and sacrifice you put in never equate to what you think you're going to get when you hold that trophy, because that feeling is so fleeting. And so it's interesting because I am such a, like, I'm a pursuer. I like to pursue. I like to achieve. It's something that really brings me a lot of value. However, when I zoom out, especially in times of overwhelm, or especially in times where I'm feeling there a lot of adversity, or maybe I don't achieve what I want, maybe I do fail, when I can keep the perspective of what is most important to me, like time spent, relationships, the impact and how I make other people feel, that's when I can go, all right, like, are you doing those things? And if I'm doing those things, I can accept whatever outcome. And then I can go back and go, all right, now what? But I think that he's changed me in so many ways because, one, he's helped me to slow down. Two, he's helped me recognize and prioritize what I value most. And three, I think he's helped me, being a mom has helped me really focus on the quality of the work that I do, not necessarily the quantity.
Yeah, because by the nature of your role, there'll be an element of travel as well. I know that'll be a strain on relationship with your husband and the time that you're able to spend. And with that in mind, the presence piece is absolutely massive. I saw on your Twitter you follow Sahil Bloom, who was a guest on this show previously, and he was talking about the birth of his son Roman, and it's been really cool to watch somebody like that share their journey in fatherhood, particularly as a young guy myself. I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh wow, that's so cool to see. Yeah. And the way you speak about your son is beautiful as well. And he was talking about his son was like studying like the details of a leaf, and he was like, how funny is that, that we all are rushing around between meetings, between Teams calls, between Zoom calls, between podcasts, between writing a newsletter, between posting on LinkedIn or whatever, and this little guy is just fascinated by the different veins in terms of on the leaf. And he was like, how good would it be if we could all have, not obviously go as far as that, but get some element of that presence and introduce that, so our children are teaching us lots of things.
Yeah, I think that's, I love that, because, you know, I think that's what I'm trying to say when I talk about quality, because quality for a child is attention. I mean, That's what they want. They want your attention. And my husband and I will notice it in each other, and we call each other out because we asked each other to do this. But like, you know, when you're busy and you get on your phone, and my son's sitting right there and I'm on my phone, my husband's like, "Hey, you're doing it." And I'm like, "Oh my God, thank you." And I can put it down, and it's because when you're fully there with them and you watch their learning, it is so fun. It's like so interesting to see the world through the eyes of a child and their ability to see it for the first time, experience it for the first time, that newness, that excitement. And like you said, and like Salil said, is that presence. It opens your eyes when you're in it. And it certainly has done that to me.
It's very powerful. And I love the way you talk about it. In terms of working in a really high powered elite environment like the Yankees, or any form of professional sport, I guess not every athlete will immediately come on board with the idea of working on their mental performance personally.
Right.
What is that like when somebody maybe does resist, and what can you do to bring them on board and see the benefit that you can bring?
I'll tell you a story. I was at the Yankees, and we had these intake forms. We would have players fill out, especially if they were new draft picks or whatever. And so they'd fill out these forms, and it would help us guide our first conversation with them, get some really interesting feedback on how they currently viewed mental performance. Have they had experience? Was it good? Was it bad? You know, all that history stuff. So I call this guy into my office, and he sits down, and I pull out his intake form, and he goes, "Hey, I'm just going to stop you." I said, "Sure. What do you got?" He said, "I filled that out of courtesy." And I said, "All right, so do you want to go over it?" He goes, "No." So I just ripped it in half, balled it up, threw it in the trash, and I go, "You got 30 minutes. Anything you want to talk about?" I found out his dad had stage 4 cancer. I found out he was looking at rings to propose to his girlfriend. I found out that he actually had a bad experience in mental performance, and so he's a little skeptical going into this. And that was more information I could have ever gotten from going through his intake form. And it led me to really believe that the worst mental skill is a forced one. It's one that's not welcomed by the person on the other side. And so he and I, our relationship began just talking as people. I would see him, "Hey, how's your girlfriend doing? Hey, how's your dad? How was his treatment this week?" And what started as just a human bond turned into mental performance at some point, but it wasn't on my timeline and it was on his. And I was okay with that because little by little, he'd be like, "All right, I'm interested." Like there was a book I loved and an author I love, and he like couldn't stand him. He's like, I'm not reading his books. Where finally he goes, "All right, if you tell anyone, I'm going to deny it, but can you send me his book?" I was like, yes. I was like, "And give me your honest feedback." So it began this, it took time. But to me, sometimes those things do, and that's okay.
You had to earn the right, and you had to let him lower his barriers at his pace.
Amen. I think the best advice I was given before I entered baseball was, "Lauren, let it come to you." And so that's what I did. And I find that that's the best way, because I think anytime you try and force something, even if you know that's what they need, if they don't believe it and they're not ready to hear it, it's not going to be of benefit. So I just don't think it's our job to tell people how to fit, like you need to be fixed and this is how. I think it has to be a collaboration, and it has to be something, you have to have that relationship. And there was, I'm going to forget who said this, but he said, you have to build a relationship that can bear the weight of truth. And I had to build that. I didn't have the relationship to be honest and truthful in those areas. And when I was, and I earned it, we were able to have those difficult conversations from time to time, and they were beneficial. But before then, I don't think so.
Yeah, building that working relationship takes time. And for some people, they might be like we've all come across them, like a chronic oversharer, and they come in and they unload on you straight away, and they're happy to talk about anything, or they're really open-minded to mental performance. Because I think a key part of what you mentioned about that chap's kind of challenge with you was that he'd had a negative experience previously. So his guard was up before he'd even met Lauren. He saw the title, mental performance coach or mental coordinator, whatever the term was at the Yankees. And he was like, not for me.
Correct. Absolutely. And so I agree. I like the way that you said that it's an earned right. And I've made the mistake before really early on in my career, giving really harsh criticism and feedback to somebody that I didn't have a relationship with. And I spent the next few years rebuilding it. But I'll tell you, I never made that mistake again. And so I tell people, I'm like, look, I want you to avoid what I did, because I made a big mistake doing that.
One of your favorite pieces of content that I've watched in recent times, and this is something that I bookmarked a long, long time ago when I first came across your work, was talking about the challenge versus threat mindset. And one of the things that I learned from that was how different our body responds based on the language that we use. If you remember making that piece of content, can you explain that a little bit for me?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have this conversation with people all the time. I think because it resonates so well. I'll tell the story that kind of like paints the picture for everybody. But I was working with a golfer, really, really good golfer, and she was incredible. So typically in golf tournaments, there's three rounds. There's the first two rounds, then you make the cut, and then you play the final round. And so the first two rounds, she was like top five every time, consistently, like crushed it, come out of the gate and just be in contention every single time. Then that final round, everything would change. She would be in the top 3 to 5. And then suddenly little by little, she would just start to shrink into the background, and she would always end just either outside top 10 or in the middle. And so I started to go like, okay, hold on. Now this is a pattern. And what I started to realize was the difference that she was playing to win in the first two rounds. And in the final round, she was playing not to lose. And so when you play to win, you understand that mistakes are a part of the process. Okay. You play with confidence. You play, you're willing to take on challenge and risk, where when you're playing not to lose, it's almost like you go into protection mode. You play hesitant, you play reactive. You're just trying not to make a mistake. And so she was shifting between these mindsets in the first two rounds versus the last one. And this is the difference where the science piece comes in, is that's the challenge versus threat. When you view something as a challenge, your body actually responds to bring you to it, right? It helps you to meet the moment. And so what happens is when you look at it as a challenge, your body actually, your heart rate variability goes up, your blood vessels, they actually, they stay the same size, meaning that they create more oxygenated blood, which means you can think more clearly. So you have better cognitive functioning. And a lot of people report feelings of confidence. And so it's not to say it's not scary. It's not to say there isn't a threat present, but you're looking at it as like, I'm ready for this challenge. I got this. I'm prepared. Where by simply interpreting the exact same event as a threat, your body responds completely different, and your blood vessels actually constrict, keeping oxygenated blood closer to your internal organs. So as a golfer, you can imagine how like that's not good, right? Because you need your limbs to be like full with oxygenated blood. And then what happens is actually you have less cognitive function because you're not getting that blood to your brain. And you have a lot more feelings of fear that is associated, and your heart rate variability goes down. And so what we recognize, you know, what you can see in this study is, I can tell you about the study and you can link it, but is that just by simply your interpretation of the events that you're in can actually shift how your biology responds. And so I find that super fascinating. And that's how I like to describe it to a lot of the people I work with, is that feeling of, when you're starting to play not to lose, you go into that threat mindset.
That is mindset isn't everything and it impacting everything in a nutshell, really, because if you think about one of the traditional terms, and I think it probably comes from the States, is like choking. So on the final day, she's kind of choking because she's seized up. Her swing's not as fluid. She's got the yips over putts. She's pulling them left of the hole because her action is not the way it would be if she was in her free-flowing, calm, like winner-like state. And that is largely caused by the stress response to the body in terms of seeing everything as a threat. Like, oh, if I miss this putt, I'm going to fall 2 shots behind. Whereas if she just followed through on that action that she's probably done hundreds of thousands of times, and she's put in the kind of fabled 10,000 hours of Malcolm Gladwell to be an expert, she would be able to perform it, or at least give herself the best possible opportunity to be successful. Whereas when you are on the defensive and almost restraining yourself and trying, like playing not to lose, as you said, it's such a reductive action to take, and it gives you so much more chance of not being successful.
Oh, it's so true. It's like when you experience the trade-off of feeling threatened to really reminding yourself of what's possible, it's incredible to see how that plays out in actual sport. And I think that just that simple shift, it's like in those moments, sometimes we feel like we need to fix, we need to be taught. But in those moments, we actually just need reminders. Like, you have trained, you have done everything that you need to do to be able to execute in that moment. Sometimes, most of the time in performance, it's a simple reminder and directing our focus in a way that's going to actually create, you know, productive forward movement versus, you know, that restrictive feeling that you were just describing.
Absolutely. If that's one example of improving self-talk, what's another example that you've maybe worked on that somebody listening could resonate with?
Yeah, I kind of hinted at the question earlier. I think I like to, when we're talking about self-talk, I struggled with this a lot myself. And I even wrestled with it outside of my master's degree, because I thought positivity was the answer and negativity was the problem. And when I started to apply some of these principles, and there is some sort of truth to that, I guess you could say, but I started to change the verbiage from positive and negative to productive and unproductive. Because what I realized is that sometimes being a little hard on yourself can be productive. Sometimes looking in the mirror and telling yourself the hard truth is not always a positive thing, but that truth, that reality, can actually move the needle and be very productive. And so I think that, you know, positivity is not always the answer and negativity isn't always the problem. And so when I looked at that, I went, okay, I actually think that the better way to respond to self-talk is actually through questions. And so one of the questions that works super well for me, and my husband loves this because he said it to me once and he's like, I'll take full credit for it. He loves the credit, let me tell you. Right? It was actually, I was driving with him to Vegas and I was typing on it. I was like working on my computer and I had this email come in. And it was one of those emails that you just makes you want to throw your computer out the window. And I was so frustrated. And I was like, I can't believe that's what they would offer me. That is like offensive. I was so upset. And he stopped me and he said, Lauren, what typically helps in moments like these? And it like stopped me in my tracks. And what he was doing is called distancing. And so you can mentally distance from the emotion, yourself from the emotion you're feeling, and creating that space that you referred to earlier by asking questions. And so when I realized, when I said, what typically helps in moments like these, the ruminating thoughts I was having and the frustration I was feeling was not actually productive. What actually typically helps is, and this is what I told him, I said, putting my computer down, giving myself 24 hours to respond. And he's like, great, then do that. And so even sometimes asking yourself that in performance, getting frustrated, speeding up, ignoring your process is not always productive. So I was like, all right, sometimes just by asking yourself that question, the most productive thing is to, all right, focus on what I can control, get back to my process, and make another swing. And so I know for me, when it comes to self-talk, actually more questioning helps versus like a scripted pre-ready thing, because it may not be applicable in the moment. And I have a really hard time with scripting something that doesn't match my reality.
Yes. One of the terms in the UK might be like horses for courses. So you can't like, or in the same way, I spoke to a gentleman called Dakota Robertson recently. Maybe you've seen his stuff on Twitter. He's absolutely brilliant. He's good friends with Danny as well, who's been on the show too. And I love him as a host. Dakota was saying you can use a hammer to build a house, or you can use it to whack your finger with it. Like, it's the same for many of the different frameworks of self-talk you could employ. It might just not be appropriate at all for that moment in time. It might not need a hammer. It might need a chisel. It might need TLC. It might not need Whacked. And I think it's so important that you use the right tool at that moment in time. And I love a question like that in terms of what would normally be helpful in this sort of situation, because it almost falls back to, what have you done before when this has been successful? And fingers crossed, you've got an example that was successful, or at least you could maybe have a role model or somebody that you know handles these situations better. So if, for example, you, God forbid, somebody's getting divorced, you might be like, okay, well, do I know somebody that handled the divorce in a way that I admired, that I thought was a great way of doing it? Okay, that's maybe what would work in this situation versus my immediate visceral response I went through. If you know somebody that's just gone through a redundancy and you've come up to the same sort of circumstance, you can base your response on how somebody that you admire has done that as well. And I think in this day and age, we are quite lucky and quite fortunate to almost stand on the shoulders of giants, because we do get access to all these different online role models and mentors to maybe emulate. If I don't have the experience to draw on when I ask myself that wonderful framework question, maybe I can pick somebody from my online role models to model in that sense.
Yeah. And I think too, sometimes we don't always know what we want or what works. So I always like to flip the question. What typically hurts me in times like these, you know, beating up on myself, speeding up, you know, not slowing my breathing down. Sometimes those things can actually reveal the answers better than what typically helps. So I just think it's knowing what question to ask when. And you can, some people, like for me, I now know my toolbox pretty well. I know what works well for me. And it doesn't mean it's not evolving. But when I ask myself that question, I have an answer for myself. Where if you don't, this could be some good questions to ask yourself before competition, so that come time when you need them, you're not searching and going, I don't know. You have a couple things that you can go to that you can lean on when you need them.
Yeah, I'm certainly writing those down for use at a later date. And one of the things that I've written down for you previously is your formula, beliefs plus actions equals your identity. What do you mean by that?
So I was... I kind of came up with this when I was working. Again, this is another story. When I was working at the Yankees, my role at the Yankees, I worked throughout our minor league system, and I was in charge of about six teams, and I would go to these travel between all these different teams. And I took a lot of pride in knowing my players. And I was at a affiliate, and I'm sitting in the dugout of this game and chatting it up with some of the players in between innings. And this one player who I've had many interactions with before was really short with me. And I found it to be really odd. And so I would like ask him a question. It was like one word answers. And so I'm smart enough to know I'm not for everyone. So it's not like I need everybody to be like, hey, Lauren, it's great to see you. Let's chat it up. Like, I'm not expecting that. But I had never experienced this before with him. So I thought, oh shoot, I hope I didn't say something and I'm just unaware of it that has shifted something in our relationship. So I was on my way to batting practice in the batting cages, and I get there early, like I usually did. And he is the only one there practicing by himself. And I'm like, this poor kid is like, I can't get away from her. Like, I'm like, oh my God. So I finally decided to just address it. I felt like it was just he and I, it was an appropriate time. So I said, hey, can I ask you a question? And he's like, yeah, what do you got? I said, I just want to make sure, like, have I said anything to offend you or to upset you in any way? Just when I asked you some questions earlier, I just felt you being really short. And I just want to, if you don't want to talk to me, that's fine. But I was like, I just want to make sure, like, I wasn't unaware of something. And he just kind of looks at me. He's like, no, that's not it at all. And so I responded, like, could you expand? Like, what might it be? And he said, I'm not very good at speaking. And I kind of was like confused by that. I was like, okay. So do you mind if we dive into that a little bit more, like at a more appropriate time? He's like, yeah. So after the game, he comes into my office and I said, when was the first time you were ever told you weren't good at speaking? And he kind of sat back and he took a couple minutes to think about it. And he finally went, it was in elementary school. And he said, I really struggled to read. And I would stutter as I would read out loud. And one day my teacher actually just told me, like, honey, you're just not very good at speaking. And it was like this moment where it like crushed me, my heart. Like I was like, I just felt it for this kid. And then I finally told him, I said, who's telling you that now? And he stopped and he just went like, I am. It's like, here's this like identity that was handed to him as a kid from, you know, somebody who, you know, who knows, maybe they had really good intentions when they said it, but didn't realize the impact. And he just picked it up and has carried it for all of these years. And so I described it. I said, all right, your identity equals your beliefs plus actions. His belief was that he wasn't good at speaking. And every time he acted in support of it, it confirmed this identity that he had for himself. And so then I asked him, I said, is that who you want to be? And he like looked at me immediately, like without hesitation, was like, no. He's like, I wish I could go up to my coaches and not feel terrified to have a conversation with them. Because I'm like afraid to speak to authority. I just like, I have a lot of good things to say, Lauren. And when you come and speak to our team, I don't feel like I can say them. And so I said, okay. I said, well, we can rework this formula to where we just switch out identity and belief. And so belief equals identity plus actions. So I said, identity is not something that we are going to get as a result of a belief. We're going to create our identity. And so he's like, okay. So I said, well, who do you want to become? And he explained, I want to become the type of person who can go up to my coach and ask him how I'm doing. I can ask questions and not be afraid. I can raise my hand in your meetings. I said, great. Now we can't just like go eat a sandwich. Like we've got to actually like do something if we want this to change and evolve, right? So I was like, so what actions do we have to take to support this new identity? And we came up with a couple. And one of them is he would come into my office before I would meet with the team. And I would pose a couple questions. Nobody knew we did this, by the way. Like to this day, nobody knows except he and I. And I would tell him the question I was going to ask in my meetings. And we would prep his answer so that come meetings, I'd ask the question, his arm would go straight up. And I said, every time you act in support of this new identity, you will start to believe it. Because belief is not just a word you say, you have to follow it with evidence. So every time you provide your brain evidence with this is the person who I am, you're going to start to believe it. And time after time he did this, and then eventually he stopped showing up to my office because he didn't have to. And he believed he was the type of person who could raise his hand.
He'd done the reps to reinforce the identity of somebody that could contribute in those settings. And until he'd done those reps, of course, he had no right. Otherwise, that would be delusional. But he took the time to do it. And he could rightfully say, I am someone that can have conversations with coaches. When Lauren asks a question at practice, I can be one of the players that puts forward an answer or a suggestion. And it's wonderful to see that timeline in action where somebody's self-limiting belief is eventually banished by their own ability to just reshape their identity. And I think we're both disciples of James Clear in that regard, because Atomic Habits, yes, is a massive element of the habits that you do have like a massive lag effect. So if the habits that I'm doing in October 2023, best believe it's probably what I'm going to be like in October 2024, because of the nature of the things that I've done. So recording great podcasts and putting them out there to the world, it makes me a podcaster. So like you need to do these things in order to reinforce the identity. Otherwise it is built on delusions of grandeur or almost uncertainty about who you truly are.
Exactly. And the second you go to test it, you don't have the confidence that's there to do it, right? And so it's just like anything else. It's like the more you practice, you increase your probability of success when you're in it. And so I agree. I think James Clear does a fantastic job of illustrating this throughout his book and how the habits that you do on a daily basis actually really confirm, number one, the way that you see yourself, but also the outcomes that you're going to get as a result of that.
That was somebody that you moved from a real low position that had never really proved themselves. I'm interested what advice you would maybe give to somebody who's previously felt successful or done well, and they're maybe fallen into a little bit of a rut, and they're listening to this podcast and they're thinking, how do I get back to my old level? How do I get back to what I'm capable of? What advice would you give them?
Well, it's interesting. I had another athlete who was struggling pretty bad at he reached a different level and he was really struggling. And his immediate response was, I'm just going to go back to what worked in high school, because he was like the guy in high school. And what I told him was, what worked for you in high school will never play in the big leagues. Every new level will require a new level of you. And so that's where that evolutionary piece comes into play. And a lot of times when people come to me with something like that, it's because they've stopped. It's they've reached the top of the mountain and they're shocked to see that there's more mountains behind them, thinking that that was the finish line. We got here and that's it. And so now they're stuck because they're like, I wasn't expecting that. I'm exhausted. And it's almost like they have to have like this, it's like the gap between the acceptance of there's another climb versus like the breaths or the debrief of the one that they just did. And I get it. But a lot of times what happens is they reach a certain level and they don't think about another goal. They don't think about the next step. And that leaves us stuck until we get to a point where we're uncomfortable enough that it moves us. And so I think that that's where we go into a really a deep discovery process with them in terms of what areas are we getting stuck on and what things do we need to evolve and what things from our past that worked, can we continue? Because I don't think it's throw it all away and we have to start all over again. But if you think what worked for you in high school is going to work at the big leagues, like maybe some, maybe. But like that ain't going to play. And I'll tell you that from experience. And so I just think that sometimes it comes as a shock that this new level is going to challenge us at a different level than we've ever been challenged before.
Yeah. And just assessing what those new habits are, and it can fall back into that identity piece. Like your identity previously was successful at a particular level or in a particular industry or a particular domain. You see it a lot with athletes that maybe turn their hand to business after, after they retire. They need to create a relatively new identity. And of course they can use the discipline and the resilience and whatever else they built when they were trying to perform at the top level in the business world, it might serve them really well, but they need to maybe sharpen some of the other areas that they've neglected in the past and turn that kind of new identity into how they perform. And of course, get out of whatever rut they found themselves in.
Yeah. And I find this one strategy to be really helpful, regardless of what level you're at. Frank Shamrock, former MMA fighter, is now retired, but he trains a lot of fighters. And there's this one technique he uses, and it's called the plus minus equal. He makes every fighter find a plus, okay, somebody who's better than them. Then he makes them find a minus, someone that they can teach and apply what they're learning. And then an equal, somebody that they can really like compete against and really test what they know against. And so I love that because no matter where you are, there's always somebody who is better at something. There's always somebody that you can teach and apply, because if you can't teach it, like, I'm not so sure how well you know it. And so that challenges your ability. It really challenges your knowledge on a different level, because sometimes you don't really know how little you know until you try and teach something. Trust me, I am guilty of this myself. And then that equal, because if we are unfairly evaluating ourselves based on there's somebody way higher than us, we can feel defeated really quick. And that can actually stop us from continuing because it feels like, oh my gosh, I'm never going to improve. So there is something to say when you find somebody that's kind of equally yoked as you to really test your stuff again. So I think when we look at that, and for somebody that's at the height of where they are, when you challenge them to find a plus minus equal, it actually really helps open up some ideas. Instead of looking so internally at ourselves, we're able to look outside of us and go, oh, I can see where maybe there are some areas where, oh yeah, this person really inspires me in this way. I can improve here. So that's another strategy that I like to use.
Huge fan of that strategy. And I really, really strongly resonate with the teaching element, because I can recite so many more lessons now from previous guests that I've had on because I've explained them to other people. I do a solo podcast every 10 episodes where I answer questions from the listeners on Instagram and on my email list. And I always say I would not be interesting in that 10th episode without the previous 9 guests that I can draw lessons from. And best believe my recall, my ability to bring forth actionable insights, and I'm going to have so many from this discussion, Lauren, I promise you, that I can bring forward. It makes me so much more well-versed in actioning those in my own life, but then teaching them onto others reinforces it, and my ability to articulate it is an absolute superpower for my retention as well, which is a great place to be.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. My little trick that I always use is I go, how would I explain it to my mom? And if I can explain it to my mom simply, then okay, I got it, because she's a really smart lady. She now knows quite a bit of what I do, but I very much at the beginning, she was like, I don't know any of this. So it's like, how do you explain it in layman's terms? Like, if you can't explain it simply, that tells me that I don't know it well enough. And so even still, like, I still use that, because I can go back and be like, you know, how would you explain to your mom, like, who's not in the field, who really only knows it because she listens to you online and that's about it. And so it's a good barometer for me to like really think about, do I know it well enough?
Great barometer and great measure for us to wrap up on, Lauren. I've absolutely loved this conversation. I'm sure the listeners have as well. Where should they head towards to continue the conversation with you?
They can find me. I'm on quite a few social media channels, but the best way to find all those channels would be to go to my website, which is laurenjohnsonandco.com. And that's fully spelled out, ANDCO.com, because Lauren Johnson is quite a popular name. So all of my handles are different.
No problem, Lauren. That'll be linked in the show notes. Thank you so much to you. And thank you to you, the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.